Audio Renaissance presents Instant Healing by Serge Kahili King, read by the author.
Here is Serge Kahili King.
Aloha. As the title indicates, this is a program about drug-free instant healing, which I define as significant or even complete healing results for a variety of conditions, including the healing of broken bones, in less than an hour. That's right, less than an hour. Some of the methods require you to think quite differently about mind-body relationships, but the potential results are well worth the stretch in your belief system. Because instant healing is not feasible for all conditions under all circumstances, these methods also work for rapid healing, which is healing that takes less than one day, and fast healing, which takes place in less than one week. The methods you will learn have been used successfully by myself, my family, and thousands of people whom I have taught. Some of the results may seem miraculous in view of current ideas about health and illness, but I'm not talking about miracles. This program is about practical ideas and techniques that work. Simple methods that anyone can apply. What are some of the events that led to my writing this program? Well, in a nutshell, my father was an MD, and he knew a great deal about the function of the body. He knew a great deal about the mind as well. At an early age, he'd been adopted by a Hawaiian man from Kauai and trained in a particular form of traditional knowledge. Years after my father's death, I received a telephone call one evening from a woman who claimed to be his Hawaiian sister. She invited me to come visit her the following weekend to meet her father and talk story, a Hawaiian term for sharing ideas and experiences. The visit was a major turning point in my life. In a simple ceremony, the woman's father, who was also my father's adoptive Hawaiian father, adopted me as a grandson. He turned me over to his daughter, now my aunt, to be my teacher in the same tradition in which my father had been trained. There was mention of a brother, Wana, who would be my new uncle, but I wouldn't meet him for many more years. Auntie Laka, as I called her, was a lovely Hawaiian about 10 years older than me. She taught massage and meditation at an informal school, and I spent the next 2.5 years under her tutelage. I learned everything I could learn about how the body responds to loving touch, emotional energy, and mental symbols. My next major acquisition of healing knowledge came to me in Africa, where I was managing socioeconomic development programs for an American voluntary agency. Here, I think, was the real beginning of my understanding of the links between beliefs and the body. I witnessed rituals that caused both illness and healing. I learned how zombies were created. I was given herbs that supposedly instantly cured snake bites and the wounds of poison arrows. I was taken to energy springs and healing waters. I learned killing chants and curing songs. I participated in rituals and experiences that radically transformed my ideas of reality and possibility. In one of my most profound experiences, I lay dying of malaria in the sub-Saharan savannah, when an African shaman came to me in a dream. He told me that if I truly wanted to live, I should eat the liver of a freshly killed antelope hanging outside my tent. When I awoke, I crawled out of my tent, asked my companions to prepare the liver for me, ate it, and lived. Not instant healing, but pretty darn rapid. In between all the magic and mystery, I became a specialist in community development, the art of helping people to help themselves. In the process, I gained priceless knowledge about the secrets of human motivation. About a year before leaving Africa, while on a trip back to the United States to take care of some family business, I encountered my Hawaiian uncle, Wana. During intense but sporadic meetings in various places over the next 7 years, he guided me through deeper and deeper levels of shamanic healing practices. On returning to the States for good, I earned a master's degree in management. Based on many years of study and practice, I opened a hypnotherapy clinic and did energy research while working on my PhD in psychology and continuing to work with my uncle. During this period, I intensively explored the healing effects of words, imagination, energy fields, and body movement. Eventually, I formed an organization to train healers and teachers, wrote books, invented energy devices, and gave many workshops all over the world that added to my knowledge of healing. So now that you know a little more about me and the wellsprings of this program, let's learn the reasoning behind the instant healing concept, and, even more importantly, how to do it. In the words of a Hawaiian proverb, Ahuwale Panani Huna, that which was hidden shall be revealed. The next time you stub your toe or smash your finger in a door, how would you like to be able to heal it yourself in less than 5 minutes with no pain and no bruises? What if you could heal a burn in the same way, or get rid of a cold in under an hour? Wouldn't it be great if long-term headaches, depression, stiffness, pain, and many other problems could disappear in an hour, a day, or even a week? Well, the ideas and techniques presented here can do just that for you, as they have for thousands of others around the world. They may not work for everyone all the time, but they will work so fast, so effectively, and so often, that you will truly be amazed. I was trained in the Hawaiian shaman system of healing, but in my life as a healer, I have also explored the most advanced techniques of the Western world and the most primitive techniques of the undeveloped world. One very significant thing I have noted is that no matter which system is used, some people are healed through it, some people are not healed through it, some people are healed without it, and some people are healed in spite of it. The best way for you to get the results you want is to understand how healing works. So let's look at some of the ways that are used around the world to heal the body. And as long as I'm talking about various methodologies, I want to mention at this point that you should be aware that some healthcare professionals have differing opinions about the implications of the content of this program. The ideas, suggestions, theories, and techniques you are about to hear should not be used in place of other sound medical therapies and recommendations. This program is not intended to replace any other form of treatment. When in doubt, always seek professional help. Getting well is more important than proving a point. Now, how do we heal? First, there are the physical methods, which include medicine, herbs, diet, nutritional supplements, surgery and bone setting, chiropractic and massage, exercise, magnetism, fasting, and deep breathing. Second, there are emotional methods of healing, such as affection and attention, laughter and play, anger release, fear confrontation, forgiveness, color, aroma, and music. Third, there are mental methods, such as placebos, hypnosis and self-hypnosis, talk therapy, guided imagery, visualization, positive thinking, affirmation, and meditation. And finally, there are spiritual or metaphysical methods of healing that include pyramids and crystals, aura cleansing, therapeutic touch, homeopathy, acupuncture and acupressure, prayer, faith, and ritual. This is truly amazing. If the body can be healed by all these different methods, and there are countless case histories to support the healing effects of each of these methods, and many more, then it seems clear that each and every method is just a means by which one thing, the actual healing process, takes place. No one theory of the healing process can be considered adequate when another gets the same effect. Therefore, something else is happening instead of, or in addition to, what the theorists say. Healing starts when there's a need for it. When a person gets into a state of disharmony by way of illness, disease, or injury, the body responds by trying to recover on its own. Sometimes an individual consciously tries to help, with or without the aid of others. Sometimes others try to help the individual, with or without his conscious help. When the attempts at recovery and help are effective, the person gets better. I'd like to look at a possible common thread that links all the different kinds of disharmony, and that is the stress factor. No matter what kind of disharmony one is talking about, no matter what the name of the disease or illness that may be involved, and no matter whether the condition is primarily physical or mental, there is always some degree of physical tension present. It's common to think of tension as a result of illness, but let's play with another idea. What if tension were not an effect of illness, but the cause? If this were so, then all one would have to do to promote healing would be to relieve the tension. That's the assumption this program is based on. But before I discuss relieving tension, let's examine the ways in which tension builds up in the first place. We'll begin by looking at the source of tension itself, a thing called stress. Stress can be defined as a constraining force or influence, as a force exerted when one thing presses on, pulls on, pushes against, or tends to compress or twist another thing. Especially the intensity of this mutual force and the deformation caused in a thing by such a force. The plain language translation is that stress is not only the action of pressing, pulling, pushing, compressing, or twisting, it is also the reaction of pressing, pulling, pushing, compressing, or twisting against the other force. Stress isn't stress unless there is resistance. It's the resistance that causes the tension, and the tension that causes the problems. And note that a constraining force or influence can also come from a lack of something, such as food or water or love, and is not limited to something active. Stress, in and of itself, isn't bad. It's vital for building muscles, moving, breathing, motivation, and a number of other things that are useful and necessary. But if you try to lift a heavy weight for too long, the muscles will break down instead of build up. If you eat so much healthy food that your stomach is ready to burst, you are doing yourself more harm than good. If you try to save the world by making people change, you'll be so stressed that you'll accomplish very little. Examine your own experience, and you will find that it is not just the ordinary stress of daily living, but excessive stress over a period of time that causes the severe problems. One might describe this as too much tension, although too much will differ among individuals and circumstances. From now on, when I talk about stress, I mean the excessive kind. Physical stress is a relatively simple phenomenon to describe. After engaging in physical effort for a long time, the body begins to resist the activity more and more until exhaustion or accident forces it to stop. I would point out, though, that the more enjoyable the effort seems to be, the longer you can continue it, because you're not resisting it as much. Less resistance means less tension, and less tension means less effect from the stress. If you love to play volleyball, you may be able to do it for hours and hours and end up pleasantly tired but exhilarated. If you hate to do housework or clean out the garage, however, you may end up exhausted and achy after only a couple of hours. Another kind of physical stress that produces tension occurs when you are poked or prodded with something sharp, hard, or excessively hot or cold. Although you don't think it's strange to be cut or bruised or burned by such contact, some people's injuries remain for a long time, while others are able to heal very quickly. Having healed broken bones, burns, and bruises of my own in under an hour many times, I can tell you that reducing tension as quickly as possible is a critical factor in the length of the healing process. Physical stress can also come from reactions to the environment. Allergies are so common that many people take them for granted, and some people are highly sensitive to trace amounts of natural and man-made chemicals, and to electromagnetic radiation. The body tries to protect itself against such intrusions, not only by internal chemical means, but also by creating a barrier of muscle tension. And then there is the stress caused by such things as hunger, thirst, and lack of movement. It's easy to see how physical stress can cause physical tension. The effects of emotional stress, on the other hand, are more difficult to identify. This stress is usually thought of as generated externally, or, in other words, by what someone else is doing to you. This perception is so widespread that many people are paid compensation for the emotional stress that others have caused them. In fact, emotional stress happens only when you become afraid or angry or excited, and all of these are internally generated responses. It's easier and sometimes financially profitable to blame others for making you feel bad, but you really do it to yourself. One person may be bothered excessively by a situation that would be taken in stride by another. Your attitude toward what others do has more effect on you than what they do. The emotions most likely to cause stress are fear, anger, and excitement. Of course, there are variations and levels of these emotions. Emotions related to fear are anxiety, panic, terror, and embarrassment. Emotions related to anger are jealousy, envy, sadness, depression, and grief. Excitement includes enthusiasm and positive anticipation. In a state of fear, your body is trying to get away from what is fearful. It would actually run if it could. If you decide not to run, the impulse to do so is still there, and the conflict between the impulse to run and the decision not to run causes physical tension. In extreme fear, the tension can become so great that fainting occurs or body functions are impaired. In an angry state, your body is trying to push something away, forcefully change it or hurt it, and any of these impulses causes tension too, especially when they're suppressed. Fear and anger are used to resist people and situations, and that gets translated by our body into physical tension. Sustained excitement can lead to tension caused by the body's need to rest. Acute or chronic fear, anger, or excitement can be very stressful in terms of the physical tension they produce. Then there is the mental stress factor. Your slightest thought causes a slight physical response. Your strongest thoughts cause strong physical responses. Remembering, imagining, planning, speculating, wondering, meditating, and any other form of mental activity have corresponding physical effects. That means your body automatically tries to carry out the physical equivalent of your thoughts by activating your nervous system, modifying your breathing pattern, altering your hormonal or other chemical output, and adjusting your muscle tension, among other things. If you remember water skiing, the muscles you used when you did it twitch right now in resonance with the mental act of remembering. If you wish you could kick your boss in the rear, the muscles required to do that tense up in preparation for the act. The more abstract your thinking, that is, the less related your thinking is to any kind of physical action, the less response there is in your body. However, sustained abstract thinking accompanied by shallow breathing and an unchanging posture can result in unhealthy physical tension. Criticism, denial, doubt, confusion, and conflicting beliefs or motivations all produce mental stress and can cause physical tension. Criticism by itself is similar to anger without the depth of emotion. When you criticize, you are experiencing an impulse to push, change, or hurt. And when the body tries to respond to the impulse, the effect produces physical tension. Denial is a mental version of fear, with the same impulse to move away from something and the same kind of tension that results. Doubt occurs when ideas are in conflict, and confusion occurs when choices are in conflict. When your stressful thoughts also generate stressful emotions, the effects of emotional stress are added to the effects of mental stress, and physical tension is increased even more. There is also a spiritual stress factor. The main symptoms of what I call spiritual stress are apathy and the severe form of boredom called ennui. Although headaches and other physical and behavioral symptoms can also be connected with spiritual stress. Apathy comes from a habit of increasingly distancing oneself from surrounding values, emotions, and activities, to the point where a person is less and less stirred or motivated by the things that affect and interest other people. Apathy could be called the spiritual version of anger, because it seems to be a coping response to a sense of being helpless or frustrated. Instead of feeling angry or depressed about being helpless or frustrated, some people simply suppress feeling. Unfortunately, the only way to do this is to keep muscles in a state of tension so that feelings can't be felt. And more unfortunately, if enough additional stress of any kind is added to the mix, the effort to hold back feelings may break down and allow an outburst of violence. It is quite common for people who suddenly break out in a frenzy of aggressive activity to be described by people who know them as quiet and unobtrusive. I remember meeting a man who was very placid until someone did something he didn't like. Then he became quietly menacing, I'm glad no one did anything to upset him while I was around. Ennui is the spiritual counterpart of denial. The state of ennui, however, is characterized by a denial of importance rather than existence. This is related to a sense of being unwanted or unloved. By this method of coping, a person tries to pretend that it doesn't matter. It's a variation on running away and, therefore, a version of fear. When this form of turning away from others and from the world becomes acute or chronic, it can also produce physical tension. Many modern healing systems are often ineffective because they are overly exclusive. They tend to treat illness as being caused only by physical or emotional or mental or spiritual conditions, and to reject some or all of the others as having no bearing on the problem. Yet tension can come from any of these realms, and there's usually a combination of more than one in a particular symptom. Even something as simple as a smashed finger can be related to feelings of guilt or confusion about a life direction, or to spiritual alienation, or to all three at once. If the finger is only treated at the physical level, the healing will be slowed down by the tension being maintained in one of the other conditions. A healer ignores any one of them at the peril of the healee. Frequently, dramatic improvement in mental health occurs through nutrition. Tumors are removed with hypnosis. An emotional release cures spiritual apathy. In my view of healing, excessive physical, emotional, mental, or spiritual stress, or any combination of these, causes the excessive tension that produces illness or disharmony. It follows, therefore, that reducing or removing the stress, either the external condition or the internal resistance, would allow a relaxation of the tension that would either result in a healing or greatly benefit the healing process. If tension is the illness factor, what is the healing factor? As I've related, it certainly isn't the method, because too many different methods can accomplish the same thing. Is there any component in every kind of healing that would start the process? I venture to say that there is one thing, and that it has two aspects. The one thing that seems to be present in every healing is intent. Obviously, there has to be some intention or motivation on the part of the individual to get well, or it wouldn't happen. The two aspects of intent are the intent of the body and the intent of the mind. Let's first examine the intent of the body. It's unquestionable that there is a natural intention of the body to get well. In any case of illness or injury, the body immediately begins to repair itself to the best of its ability, and it uses signals such as pain or hunger to notify the conscious mind that it needs help in getting back to a state of wellness. You could call it an automatic intent. Tension interferes with the body's ability to heal itself, sometimes to the point of turning a healing response into a self-destructive act. Blood clotting, for example, is a healing response, but stress can cause it to happen at the wrong place and time. Still, there is no doubt that the body's intent to heal itself is a critical healing factor, and anything we can do to assist that intent, such as relieving stress, is useful and good. The intent of the body to heal itself may also be called the subconscious intent. The intent of the mind, however, is a conscious intent, also known as motivation, will, or willpower. Although one can assume the existence of a subconscious intent to heal as a given in all situations, the conscious intent is a variable factor. At first, it would seem that everyone would naturally want to be well. Some people, however, consciously use physical disharmony as a spiritual discipline, as a means of learning, as a means of manipulation, as a means of self-punishment, as a way of diverting rage. In other words, people are capable of multiple conflicting motivations that can either encourage or interfere with the body's will to wellness. The ability to maintain conscious intent is another consideration. You often hear about near miraculous cures that were due to a person's strong will to live or to be well. When it is said that a person has strong willpower, what is really meant is that he or she can hold a focus without being easily diverted or discouraged, whereas a person with a weak will is one who gives up or switches focus easily. So whether you call it conscious intent, willpower, or sustained attention, this is an important part of the mental aspect of the healing factor. The body's intent to heal is supported by relieving tension, as well as by providing the supplies it needs for healing, such as nutrients and oxygen. The mind's intent to be well is supported by positive expectation, or the belief that to be well is good and possible. Often this expectation or belief comes from within the individual. Perhaps more often, however, it is something outside the individual that provides the expectation. This outside something can be called a placebo, and its effect on the healing process is called the placebo effect. The placebo effect is defined as an improvement in the condition of a sick person that occurs in response to treatment, but cannot be considered due to the specific treatment used. Well, if, as seems to be the case, the results of one form of treatment can be duplicated by another totally different form of treatment, and if the only difference is what the person thinks about the treatment, then the actual method used doesn't matter very much. Whoa there! How can this be? Am I saying that medicine and surgery and diet and exercise don't really work as healing agents? Not at all. Don't panic. I'm not trying to overthrow the whole current healthcare system. I'm just suggesting they work to the degree that the patient expects them to. Physical interventions such as medicine, surgery, diet, and exercise clearly affect the body. But for a healing to take place, it seems as though they have to affect the mind as well. What exactly is it that gives placebos such power to stimulate positive expectations in the mind and in the body? Here's my theory about it. Usually one thinks of an expectation as being a strictly mental thing, either consciously intended or learned as a habit, that has little to do with healing. Naturally, you can find many instances in which a person expected to get well from a particular treatment and it didn't work. What happened in such a case? This type of event can be understood if the idea of an expectation includes the expectations of the body as well as the expectations of the mind. The expectations of the body would include subconscious expectations based on remembered experience, as well as expectations based on genetic memory. Genetic memory consists of the memories of our ancestors that we all carry around with us in different combinations. This would offer an explanation as to why different people have different responses to the same treatment, even when their conscious expectations are the same. The more familiar a form is, the better the body will respond to it. Familiarity might come from the form's appearance, for example, shaped like a pill. It might instead come from its taste, sweet or vile, or from its origins, such as a doctor's office or a shaman's hut. It could also come from anything else that is associated with a previous healing. The healing effect occurs to the degree that the familiarity makes the body feel secure, helps it to relax, and stimulates it to carry out the process of healing. If it does those things, then the form doesn't matter. Depending on your background, eating turtle eggs under a sacred tree, taking antibiotics, or analyzing your dreams could each have the same effect. The expectations of the mind, however, are conscious expectations, which are based on authority. Authority, here the power to heal, can be placed in an object or substance, in a procedure, in a person, or in a desire. A sugar pill doesn't work very well as a placebo unless it is given to you by an authority figure such as a doctor or a nurse, or if it is presented as a drug that already has a successful reputation. The better the reputation, the better the effect, and this is true for pills as well as magical amulets or the cartilage of a shark. If you are afraid of a particular form of treatment such as chemotherapy, hypnosis, occult ritual, or whatever, the resulting tension will certainly interfere with the intended effect. But if you are impressed with the form and possibilities of such a treatment, and you can hardly wait to try it out, then the effects can be miraculous. The stronger your belief that a treatment method will work, the better the effects. Shamans, doctors, therapists, faith healers, and other kinds of healers usually go out of their way to impress you with their healing ability, using things like costumes, confidence, special behavior and objects, environment, certificates, books, cost of treatment, and anything else that will convince you that they can help. The stronger your belief that a person can help, the better the effects. The conclusion is very simple. Healing happens because the body has the capability and the intent. Healing happens better when the subconscious intent is supported by the relaxation of tension and by conscious intent. Now let's look at the role played by memory in the healing process. Memory is such an important aspect of healing that you need to have some understanding of how people remember. However, I must warn you that I am now crossing into very theoretical territory. On the other hand, this whole program could be considered very theoretical territory, so what difference does it make? Given that caution, here's the explanation of memory that I use in my healing work and classes. Genetic memory is stored in the cells. Popular thinking supposes that other memories reside in the brain, but I suggest that memory of personal experience is stored in the cells of the entire body, not in the brain alone. Specifically, it is stored in cells or groups of cells throughout the body, especially muscle tissue, that are activated or sensitized at the moment an experience happens. The more actively involved certain cells are at that time, the more involved they are in recalling the memory. And because experiences include many different forms of sensory stimulation, such as sight, sound, and touch, the whole memory of an experience may be stored in bits and pieces in several parts of the body. Memories related to driving a car, for example, are stored in all the different parts of the body involved in the driving experience. When enough memories have accumulated, your body can drive easily, while your mind is primarily engaged in conversation or contemplation. When a memory is recalled, the brain acts as an information processor. It receives and transmits signals from and to the rest of the body. It may have its own experiential memory, but it is not the entire storehouse of personal memory. If a memory is requested by the body or the mind, the brain sends a message such as this: "Hey, we need a memory of how to ride a bicycle," or "Give us the memory of Marianne's party last November." The presence of an actual bicycle can stimulate a very rapid recovery of all the memories held by the various cells involved in bicycle riding. The recall of details from the party may take a little longer, typically starting with the most energetically intense part of the experience, such as the moment you broke Marianne's favorite vase, and then pulling in other memories around it. In both cases, the recall is associative. That is, memories are linked to each other by association rather than in a linear sequence. Touching the handlebars of the bicycle will trigger recall of how to sit, which will trigger recall of how to pedal, which will trigger recall of how to keep your balance, and so on. This will happen so rapidly that you probably won't notice any delay. In remembering something such as a party, however, you usually get the most intense experience first, then events surrounding that experience, then events of lesser intensity and their associations, and so on. Somewhere in the middle, the association process might leap to, for example, the first time you met Marianne, when she still thought you were a nice person. And so, on its own, the body remembers by associations of energy, similarity, symbolism, and the like, without regard to time and space. However, the mind can impose an orderly sequence to remembering. Memory itself is stored as a pattern of movement on a very small scale, like a code. Basically, the cells have an experience that is translated into a minuscule bit of movement. To recall a memory, the cells involved in various parts of the experience vibrate their code in unison and send a signal of their activity to the brain. It translates these signals into a recalled experience and gives other cells signals to take action as necessary. My research indicates that most, if not all, of our memories are dependent on key groups of cells that have to be stimulated first for recall to happen. You may say that's cute, or fantastic, or even absurd, but to my mind, practical. Look, I don't really know if this is the way memory works, but neither does anyone else, in spite of what they may claim. I use this model because it seems to fit the experience people have with memory. It answers a lot of questions about memory, and it's extremely useful in the process of healing. So I'm going to treat it as though it's true until I run across a better idea, because it's very practical to do so. Using this idea of memory to help explain motivation, expectation, energy, and stress as they relate to the body allows for the development of many workable healing techniques. It's important to keep in mind that the essential motivation of the body is to move toward pleasure and away from pain. The reason is very simple. Pleasure feels good and pain feels bad. The body remembers this, and so it loves the one and fears the other. In the case of specific experiences, the body will categorize them hierarchically, according to their pleasure or pain components, as it memorizes them. Then it will seek to repeat pleasurable experiences and avoid painful ones. Or, it will put up with a certain amount of pain to reach a pleasure high on the hierarchy. This is the simple explanation for most human behavior. It tells us why children prefer video games to homework, why people climb mountains, and why people put up with painful relationships. As you grow up, your body must learn how to cope with changing circumstances and new experiences, from eating and walking, to potty training and playing, to working and illness, and all the other events of life. How does motivation affect learning, then? I'll use the example of a baby learning to walk. First, there has to be the desire to walk. It's important not to take this for granted. My eldest son didn't walk for so long that we began to think he had a disability, until one day we picked him up from a child care center to find him running. The woman in charge said he'd been crawling along quite happily, and then saw older boys having such a good time running around that he got up and joined them. Before that, he'd been carried everywhere and felt no need to walk. Most children, however, first want to see something or read something or do something that requires walking, and that's what motivates the attempt. For anything to be learned, there must be a benefit to the learning that provides the motivation to learn. The process of learning involves motivation, experience, feedback, and selective memorizing. Observing a child learning how to walk is very interesting. In the beginning, the steps are tentative as the child tries out various combinations of body movement and balance. By an adroit use of biofeedback, in other words, by finding out whether a particular combination results in falling down or staying up, the child gradually remembers what works, forgets what doesn't work, and learns the skill of walking. There you have it, the key to learning new behavior and skills. Remember what works and forget what doesn't work. That's how a baby learns, that's how a child learns, and that's how an adult learns. That's how you learn to be healthier, and that's how you learn to be sick. Hey, did I just say that the process of learning to walk is the same as the process of learning to be sick? And did I just say that sickness is a learned behavior? Yes. Everything that humans do is learned behavior. Whether it was learned first by ancestors and remembered by genes, or learned in a given lifetime and remembered by cells. Every kind of learning necessarily involves the body, and every experience that repeats itself is a learned behavior, whether you're talking about language or colds. You learn a language by means of repeating patterns of physical behavior to produce meaningful sounds because it's useful. You learn an illness by means of repeating patterns of physical behavior to produce meaningful symptoms because it's useful too. The usefulness or benefit of illness comes from its value as a means of reducing stress. It's common for a person's subconscious to generate an illness when work becomes too painful to tolerate, or for the subconscious to use illness as a means of avoiding a painful emotional confrontation. Unfortunately, much of the benefit is lost because the illness also produces stress. According to the body's hierarchy of memory, however, if the physical, emotional, mental, or spiritual benefits of an illness outweigh the disadvantages, the body will keep repeating the illness until it learns a better means of obtaining the benefits. Remember, the body's natural reaction to stress is to stress back. When the body experiences pressure, it tends to exert pressure back. This is what builds muscles in weightlifting. When the body experiences pulling, it pulls back. This is why stretching can be beneficial. When it is twisted, it twists back, which is why physical therapy can be helpful. When the body is lacking something, it tries to compensate. It would prefer to fill the void with what is lacking, but if that's not available, it will use a substitute, either a physical alternative or a symbolic alternative. This is why the body may draw calcium from one bone to try and assist another bone. Why people get cravings for things like dirt and paint, and why people who crave love may eat too much. If the body, or a part of it, seems to be in danger of imminent injury, the body will attempt to withdraw from the danger if it can, or at least surround the endangered part with a protective coating or buffer zone. That's why we get calluses and blisters, or excess fat and muscle tension. Conversely, if something seems to be attacking the body from the inside, the body will send agents to attack it back. That's why you have white blood cells and antibodies. Regardless of whether the source of a stress is an injury or a virus, the actual symptoms known as illness are produced by the body itself. Even though illness may be a distorted reaction to stress, it is still the body's best effort to cope based on what's possible at the moment. Therefore, one can say that all illness is an attempt on the part of the body to solve a problem related to stress. Healing is the effort to help the body do a better job of solving the problem. Now let's look at the effect of imagination and the mind on the healing process. The mind is an intangible entity. Of course, you know it's there because you can experience its effects, but you can't hold it or smell it or see it. For some behavioral scientists, the phenomenon of the mind is produced by physical processes within the body. Their idea of the mind-body effect is not that the mind and body interact, but that the mind is an effect of the body. However, if that's true, then what they say is only an effect of physical processes and you don't have to pay any attention to it. It might be more useful to think about the mind in terms of a metaphor and say it is like the ocean, with a lot of layers, a lot of currents, a lot of hidden places, a lot of open places, and host to a lot of useful and very weird stuff. Many people have tried to determine what the essential characteristic of the mind is, and so have I. I believe that the essential characteristic of the mind is imagination. All of the talents associated with the mind, such as analysis, synthesis, reasoning, determination, decision-making, and creativity, derive from its ability to imagine. The mind can imagine what was, what is, and what will be. Even more wonderfully, it can imagine what wasn't, what isn't, and what never will be. And on occasion, it has a hard time telling the difference. Everything that the body can experience, the mind can imagine, and then some. It's as if the mind uses memory as a springboard to create brand new experiences, first as a thought, then as a fantasy, then as a plan, then as directed activity, using imagination from beginning to end. As a matter of fact, the so-called third eye that is discussed in many spiritual teachings is really the eye of the imagination, the mind's eye. It is not the pineal gland, although that organ may play an important role in the imaginative process. Traditionally, the third eye is located in the center of the forehead, the area of the frontal lobes of the brain, while the pineal gland is located straight back in from the tip of your nose. Interestingly, damage to or destruction of the frontal lobes, as by the ill-famed process called lobotomy, seems to have the effect of inhibiting or eliminating the faculty of imagination. Another example of the body affecting the mind as much as the mind affects the body. Like the body, the mind is motivated toward pleasure and away from pain. However, pleasure and pain for the mind are not directly connected to sensations. As far as the mind is concerned, pleasure consists in rightness, and pain consists in wrongness. These two qualities do not seem to be absolute. Every human society has different criteria for rightness and wrongness, and every human being in a society has his or her own peculiar variations on the criteria. On the whole, however, rightness is associated with conformity, effectiveness, meaningfulness, importance, and knowledge. Wrongness is associated with nonconformity, ineffectiveness, meaninglessness, unimportance, and ignorance. The mind is very clever, though. Nonconformity in one person can be conformity to an ideal or a purpose in another person. Ineffectiveness in one person's view can be effectiveness in the view of another. Meaninglessness can be meaningful to someone who writes about it. Unimportant can be important as a distraction from stress. And ignorance, on occasion, is bliss. There are those who think that the highest form of mental activity is reasoning, or so-called rational thought. This is because they don't understand what the use of reason really is. Reasoning has to do with explaining or making logical sense out of something, and rational simply refers to the use of reasoning. But first there has to be an assumption on which to base the explanation or the logic. This means you have to make up or imagine an opinion about something and call it true, which turns it into a belief. Or you can borrow someone else's opinions and call them true, which turns their opinions into your beliefs. When you no longer question a belief, it's called a fact. There are relatively few facts in the world, in the sense of experiences that are common to everyone, and that are not just interpretations of experience. Gravity is a fact, but explanations of gravity are just opinions. Pain is a fact, but ideas about what causes it are opinions. Illness is a fact, but causes and cures come from the realm of beliefs, which are unquestioned opinions. And even actual facts are subject to beliefs. There isn't a single fact that you could name that someone else would not sincerely contradict. And that's a fact. Now, when the mind comes up with an opinion and turns it into a belief by deciding not to question it, the body remembers it and stores it as a rule that governs any related behavior. If your mother told you that you would catch a cold if you got your feet wet with your shoes on, and you accepted that as a fact, your body would adopt that as a rule and make sure that you would get cold symptoms whenever you got your feet wet with your shoes on. If you decide that you won't catch a cold if you get your feet wet while wearing certain kinds of shoes, such as reef walkers, and if you turn that into a belief by not questioning that decision, then your body will revise its remembered rule so that you can splash around on the reefs without getting a cold. Beliefs created, that is, imagined by the mind, can even override genetic beliefs inherited by the body, which is what happens in the case of so many so-called miraculous cures. The mind and the body work together all the time. Actually, it would be more accurate to say that they interact all the time, because some of their behavior could not be called togetherness. When the mind thinks a thought, the body responds. Every thought sets off neurochemical activity that corresponds to the nature of the thought. Here's a simple experiment. Take a moment and imagine you are a beggar in medieval London. You have no money, so you dip your bowl in an open sewer and take a drink. Go ahead. Smell it. Taste it. Okay, that's enough. I don't want you to gag. You probably didn't go through with it anyway. But even the thought of doing it would have initiated neurological, chemical, and even muscular activity in your body. If you did go through with it, you may have tasted foul stuff in your mouth, experienced your body growing heavy or contracted, and felt unhappy. Now imagine yourself as the king or queen of Atlantis, sitting on your throne of gold and velvet, while the ambassador of Lemuria presents you with a box made of amber and filled with rubies, diamonds, and emeralds. Hold the box. Feel the jewels, while all the court applauds your wise diplomacy. Now stop. Whether you were thrilled, amused, or bored with this little story, it will still have induced physical changes in your body. You may have felt the sensation of the jewels, experienced pleasure, a sense of lightness and expansion, or other very physical effects. If you imagine you're going to get sick, your body will scour its memory and begin to produce the physical reactions and substances to generate the appropriate symptoms. And if you imagine yourself getting well, the body will start the healing process. The link between the mind and the body is emotion. Emotions are waves of energy that carry messages. When the mind communicates with the body, the latter reacts according to the degree of emotion stimulated by the thought, while it carries elements of the thought along with it, similar to the way radio waves carry information. When the body communicates with the mind, it uses memory to get the same effect. Emotions exist only as they are felt. They are not stored any more than the waves of the ocean are. When you think a joyful thought, or when an experience triggers a joyful memory, the body generates a joyful emotion. When you think an anxious thought, or an experience triggers an anxious memory, the body generates an anxious emotion. The emotion occurs right there in the moment. When the stimulus of thought or experience is gone, then so is the emotion. Emotions are not stored. Emotions are not suppressed. You do not walk around like a warehouse of old emotions. You do not breathe yesterday's air or surf yesterday's wave. Well, if you aren't carrying suppressed emotions, why do emotions based on old events break out so strongly in a crisis? The answer has to do with a combination of stimulus response and tension energy. Tension is the body's way of suppressing the ideas it learned from the mind that would, if acknowledged, generate an unpleasant emotion. On its own, the body just expresses emotions as they come up, regardless of the consequences. But if the mind creates a belief that certain kinds of emotions are not to be expressed, or certain ideas or memories are not to be acknowledged because that would be painful or dangerous, then the body will suppress them in the only way it can, which is by tensing muscles so that they can't move. If the cells can't move, the memories will not transmit, and emotions won't exist. Think of this as setting up a barrier so the waves can't form in the first place, or as a mountain that blocks the north wind and leaves the southern ocean nice and calm. But mountains erode under the pressure of constant wind, and the body erodes under the pressure of constant tension. When the stimulus of additional related ideas or experience becomes so strong that the body cannot produce enough additional tension to suppress a reaction, or when the amount of tension present is so great it cannot be held anymore, then the result is an outburst of emotion amplified by the release of tension energy. Emotions are the means by which the mind and body communicate with each other. When the mind experiences pleasure or pain, there is an emotional response in the body. When the body experiences pleasure or pain, there's an emotional response in the mind. Every thought produces a disturbance or excitement in the body's physiology. Thoughts that don't relate to important issues of pain or pleasure cause little disturbance or excitement, and little in the way of behavioral change. The dates of the terms of office of U.S. presidents usually go in one ear and out the other, unless a test grade is involved, and the moment that the test is over, they usually disappear. Thoughts that relate directly to mental or physical pain or pleasure may cause great disturbance or excitement, depending on the degree of potential pain or pleasure involved. Thoughts of a burglar being in the house, or of picking up a grand prize that has been won, may cause massive energetic and behavioral changes. Likewise, every physiological change, however stimulated, produces a disturbance or excitement in the mind's thinking process. Accordingly, physiological changes that are not related to the mental pain or pleasure of most people may have no noticeable effect on the mind. On the other hand, behavior experienced or perceived that challenges or strongly reinforces cherished assumptions and rules of the mind may cause massive thinking activity. To summarize, you can use the mind to bring pleasure or pain to the body, and you can use the body to bring pleasure or pain to the mind. This also means that you can use either to help in healing the other. The rest of this program is about doing just that. Now I'm going to give you specific ideas and techniques to heal yourself using the power of words, the power of imagination, the power of touch, and the power of energy. Let's begin with words. Specifically, a magical word. Abracadabra is probably the most well-known magical word in the world. If you enjoy fairy tales, if you read sword and sorcery novels, or if you like movies and television series with magicians and wizards, you know how important magical words are. They are the major component of magical spells. After all, anyone can gather a few newt's eyes and lizard tongues, but if you don't know the right words to say, you're nowhere. Imagine a powerful magician with a pointy little beard wearing a black cloak with red lining. He raises his arms. Lightning flashes from his fingers, and he says in a commanding voice, "Do what I want." Not too exciting. But if he says, "Alakazam," wow, impressive. Mystery grants authority. If someone speaks gobbledygook with confidence, people who don't know that it's gobbledygook will be impressed. A friend once gave me a tape recording of a man speaking on some esoteric subject. My friend thought I should listen to it because it was extremely good. Now, my vocabulary is fairly extensive, and I studied logic in college. The man on the tape was a strong, confident speaker, but what he said was nonsense. It wasn't that I didn't agree with him. There was nothing to agree or disagree with. Most of what he said was rampant, inconsistent nonsense, and he randomly threw in big words for their sound and not their meaning. As gently as possible, I analyzed this man's talk for my friend, and he was amazed that he had been so gullible. If words are said in a certain way, or in a certain context, that can also give them more authority than their actual meaning would warrant. The words of a prayer or a political speech, or those of a doctor or a hypnotist, may have an impact far beyond their meaning because of when and how and by whom they are spoken. Fundamentally, words are sounds or arbitrary marks to which you give meaning. Languages are organizations of sounds and marks used by particular groups of people. That's all there is to it. Any power that words have is given to them by you. The more power you give them, the greater their effect on you. But the power comes from you and not the words. Speak the most powerful magical incantation in ancient Hebrew to a 12-year-old Chinese schoolboy, and you'll get puzzlement, not awe. And you won't be able to turn him into a frog, either. With that said, words are still an incredibly useful tool for healing. The most powerful use they have, as long as you understand their meaning and or give them authority, is to help you direct your attention, to assist you in sharpening and sustaining your focus. The more clearly and consistently you can focus your attention on a healing thought or intent, the more quickly and thoroughly the body will respond in a healing way. Now let's see how to use ordinary words to get magical effects. Healing by interpretation. Once when I was teaching a class, a regular member of the group arrived late, quite breathless and very agitated. After a few moments, she calmed down, just enough to tell us of a near accident she'd had on the way to class. In considerable detail, she described how a car had come out of a side street and had almost run right into her. If she hadn't slammed on the brakes as soon as she had, she would have been killed instantly. On and on she went about how she had almost been killed, and she was in a state of great fear and stress. Suddenly I interrupted and said, "But you're here and alive, aren't you?" "What?" she said, with a startled look. I repeated my statement with an added touch. I said, "You survived. You're here with us now, and that's wonderful, isn't it?" After a momentary confusion, her body relaxed, she smiled and looked around and said, "You're right." And she was happy for the rest of the evening. The woman had been locked into an interpretation of the event as a near-death experience. The words she used kept reinforcing that interpretation, and the resulting focus maintained and even exaggerated her fear and stress. Instead of a tranquilizer, however, all she needed was a shift of focus. A few words based on observable experience led her away from imagined pain and injury to the experiential reality of being alive and well. Her emotional trauma was healed in less than a minute. Reinterpreting experience is one of the most powerful healing methods there is. It can heal emotional wounds as well as physical ones, and it's all based on a choice of words. I'll describe some variations in more detail. The positive twist. The positive twist is the simplest variation. It's what I used with the woman I just mentioned. All you do is look for the good in the past event or the present result and make that the center of attention. You don't try to deny any negative experience. You just make the positive aspect more important. To the degree that you can do this, you will relieve a lot of stress that may have accumulated from dwelling on the negative side of whatever happened. The more quickly that stress can be relieved, the more quickly a healing will result. Even physical symptoms caused by such stress can disappear with amazing speed. The skinny description. Very often the negative effects of negative events are sustained and aggravated by repeatedly using loaded words in describing the events.